thank you for coming. It's good to see you all here. I hope you're all listening tomorrow to a certain radio program, but I won't plug that. It's a very interesting film, and I think we're going to have an interesting discussion, debate, contending with some of the issues that are raised in the film. I want to introduce our distinguished panel. All panels in broadcasting are distinguished, by the way. You never get the mediocre panel, at least not on purpose. Michael Higgins, I've known for a long time. He is a leading expert on the Vatican. He is a commentator. He's the former president of St. Thomas University. He's written a number of books, and he's done a lot of broadcasting. He won a gold medal at the 2013 New York Festival for Best International Documentary, and he's always working on another book. He's a great friend and a delight to have here. He currently teaches religion in Fairfield, Connecticut, and he's come up here especially to be here this afternoon. Michael Higgins. Thank you, Michael. Benjamin Williams is a psychologist at the residential treatment center called Southdown. It is for religious and clergy, has an international reputation. Dr. Williams's treatment practice includes neuropsychological assessment, individual and group psychotherapy. He also provides psychoeducational workshops and seminars. His personal faith journey was influenced by being raised in a home with a strong Christian fundamental evangelical commitment. Dr. Williams, there you are. Deirdre Pike I've just met her this afternoon, is a firecracker. She is a senior social planner for Social Planning and Research Council of Hamilton. She's also a columnist for the Hamilton Spectator. Ms. Pike is a voice for the LGBTQ community in Hamilton and is the co-founder of The Well, which is a wellness center serving the LGBTQ community. She's been involved with educational and engagement sessions within that community, and especially with the Hamilton Police Department. Deirdre Pike. Hi. And the star of the film. I've been a fan of Michael Murphy for many years, a wonderful actor, and as you could tell from this afternoon, somebody who throws every ounce of energy into the commitment. He is covered the range in terms of acting, theater, documentaries, movies. He was one of the favorite performers of Robert Altman, appearing in a number of Altman films. He's appeared in films directed by Woody Allen and Oliver Stone, all kinds of people. He's always working, and he's involved with some projects now, particularly one that involves working on a film about Bob Dylan, directed by Martin Scorsese. Mr. Michael Murphy. How are you, sir? Nice to see you. I think I will put my first question to Mr. Murphy. You recited the Confiteor like a former altar boy. It was terrific. You got the Latin down.
Well, they say the last thing to go is your long-term memory, right? I couldn't remember what I just heard, the question. But, yeah, I can remember the Catholic Church before Vatican II, believe me.
You got all the Latin. When you were approached to do the film, you were a little hesitant about it. What changed your mind?
I have a long history of playing a morally bereft character. I was always cheating on my wife and making, Jill Clayburgh throw up.
What a wonderful film that was. Yeah.
I used to refer to myself as the original whining yuppie. I should see a shrink. I'm unhappy. But I was having an affair, of course. So I didn't want to kind of close it out. As a child molester, unless it was going to be, really an interesting movie, and I worried about that kind of stuff.
How did you start out to build the character? Did you bring in your background of being raised a Catholic and taught by nuns?
It was interesting because Terry is a post-Vatican II guy and right. a pre-Vatican II guy.
You and me both, yeah.
Yeah, man. We had to bring that together, you know.
Yeah.
He would talk about singing, playing his guitar and singing Joan Baez songs at Mass, and I was appalled, you know. And nobody in my era would call a guy Father Sam, you know. So I thought that was a bit of an overreach by the new church.
Right.
You know, so it was fun to kind of, in an interesting way, to bring our heads together and make that work. When, we worked a long time on that.
When you put on the chasuble and the robes and the collar, what did you feel like? What
I felt very mind? Much at home. You know, I'd seen it a million times. I was an altar boy.
Yeah.
Between beatings. Those nuns,
with
boy,
the nuns.
I want to tell you.
Did you get whacked with a ruler?
All the time.
Enough? Yeah, me too.
I get D's in deportment, and I'd say, you know, it's not your, it's not what he says, it's that snotty look he gets on his face.
I'm curious how you start to build a character. I remember reading once that Alec Guinness said he always started with the clothes, and he worked inward. How do you?
You know, it's interesting with this. I've never done anything like this anywhere close to this, and It went on for a long time, you know. I originally thought Terry and I would have lunch, and I'd say, yeah, this is great, and I encouraged him, but I thought, you know, who's going to make a picture? You know, where are we going to get the dough for this one? And, you know, about an old guy. And it just really, over several years, I would put it on the back burner, and then I'd think about it. And then all of a sudden, you know, Marinez got involved, our producer, and, boy, it was going to go. And so it kind of happened quickly. But I had all that... I don't know, baggage that I wanted to. Yeah. Interestingly, then I'll shut up. It was fun to make this picture.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I felt that he was a good guy, you know, and I didn't get resentful about my pre-Vatican II stuff like I thought I would have. Other than to say, what I thought that was most interesting about it was kind of the end of the road, as I've stated somewhere. He was in the winter of his life, and you know, the church had kind of fallen apart in many ways from the ornate, powerful organization that I grew up in. That little church we used, you know, it had been kind of stripped down in the 60s, and what was left didn't really go with the architecture, that kind of thing, which I found really interesting.
How did you approach the whole question of ambiguity here? This is a man with a secret.
Yeah, pushed hard for it. We both pushed hard for that.
How do you get at that?
I just, you know, I can remember a specific scene, just as an example. We'd be on the set, you know, changing things, and I got into that scene where Suzanne says, you know, I wrote the letter and accuses me. And she assumed, and I can't remember whether it was still in the script or whether I would kind of get into it with her, but I said, listen, I'm not going to say I'm guilty of any of this. I'm gonna deny this to my dying breath. And then maybe when you scream at me when I'm walking outside, you know, I'll react to that. But I don't want to give that give that up, give it away, you know, and let the audience think what they want to think. Yeah. And everybody thought that was a good idea. I mean, Suzanne was a little puzzled by it at first, but then she kind of got into it. And so the movie kind of went that way. We pushed. Right. You know, as we got further into it, we got more ambiguous, it seemed to me. That's my recollection of it.
Yeah. Let me ask Michael Higgins. You've been around priests all of your life. You've taught with them. You've written about them. What's your reaction to the film and to the secret of Father Sam?
I think it's actually extraordinarily well done, very well done, Michael, because the evocation of the priest is profoundly human. I think that's what's important to understand. The function is cultic, the office is very clear, but what you attempt to do, and I think you succeed in doing, is showing us the human viscera, the reality of this priest who carries with him the weight of conscience. I mean, there's something, as I was watching the film, and I hadn't seen it before, this was the first occasion, I was thinking of it, and still think of it, as a kind of meditative riff on some of the key spiritual issues that one faces in one's life. Whether shrouded in ambiguity or not, the fact is that he has to face the haunting memory of something that happened. And the consequences of this are Augustinian. We don't escape what we do. We can become reconciled with what we have done. We can attempt to understand. We can seek reparation. But the only way we can do this is through an interior journey to understand and to accept. And you have a real sense that Sam is carrying with him a memory that has to be purged in order for him to heal. And the ambiguity that surrounds this is exactly right. Because, I mean, as I was looking at it, I thought a lesser director and a lesser actor would have you fling yourself over into the falls. Yeah. This would be a nice resolution. Now you float over the falls.
Hollywood.
Okay. That, but that wouldn't be the way it happens. And it seems to me that the imagery of the North, its sparseness, and most especially the long pauses in the conversation speak to something that I think many people don't realize about priestly life, is that it can be crushing in its banality. I mean, the rhythms of ordinary, getting up, listening,
but Michael, what
going
about
through the routine.
I wish you had been around when we were doing this.
Boy, I love to hear this. This is wonderful.
What about the scene with the dartboard where Father Sam is trying to explain if you're going to have a heaven, you're going to have a hell, or neither one? What does that say, Michael, about the kind of struggles that the priest was going through? And do all priests go through that? Do they jeopardize their faith and their vocation by thinking about these things?
No, because they speak to the spiritual maturity that comes with discernment. I mean, the line of cafeteria Catholics is a cliche now,
yeah,
right?
I know,
but the underlying truth that there is a hierarchy of truths, which is Vatican Council teaching, underscores the fact that living human beings, whether they exercise an official cultic religious responsibility or not, wrestle with dimensions of doctrine and ritual and moral teaching, because as they mature and as they grow in discernment and whatnot, they realize that their own lives are characterized by ambivalence and struggle, and they become, as a consequence, less judgmental. Perhaps the best example Roman Catholics have right now, emblematically, is the current Pope.
Oh, yeah.
Pope Francis, yeah. Yeah. Let me ask Deirdre Pike, your reaction to the film, what you saw.
Well, having spent 14 years in parish ministry, working with a number of priests around the Diocese of Hamilton in Ottawa, I thought the portrayal of the isolation, again, following up on the silences and all of that, was just so accurate. You know, I was the woman who walked in every morning and gave the mail to the priest and then carried on, you know, and tried to get him to wake up to, you know, get out of bed to go to Mass, please. You know, I can't hear confessions. Absolutely. In many different places, because I worked with tremendous men, like tremendous priests who portrayed the kind of compassion and love that you see Father Sam having as he tries to work out his own redemption for his own past. And I don't know what all the priests that I worked with had in their past, but nobody knows what I have in my past and why I run my ass off trying to redeem myself every day too. We all have something that we're running from, I think. And the how it ends up working out by saving others, you know, you can't even save your own family. Like, you couldn't go and save your own family, but you can work on everybody else's family. And you can, you know, barely get out of bed to do Mass, but, you know, you're starting your week and this poor woman you don't even know is sick and off you run, you know. So anyway, I thought it was very, very accurate in its portrayal and really leads us to have some compassion around an issue that I don't think a lot of people would have compassion if you said, this is a priest who did this thing.
Yeah.
Well, then he's damned to hell. And really, because of the way this is done, you're drawn into some other level of feeling. I think that's really important.
But how do you respond? Oh, go ahead, Michael.
Just one little thing I wanted to stick in there. We met a priest up there in the what do you call it? What do they call that place?
The Sioux.
And he was this terrific guy who had a real life, you know, before he became a priest. He, as he put it, too much blow, he says, you know, and drinking and a temper and everything. And then he became a priest later in the game. But you just said something I wanted. Oh, shoot. See, I can't remember this stuff anymore.
Finding redemption. They're talking about redemption.
Yeah. Anyway.
Delivering the mail.
You said... Running from that. I don't. I'm sorry.
Just running Christ. From your past. We all have
Jesus
something running
Christ.
From. Oh, yeah. Say a prayer. Hail Mary. Remember how it goes? Hail Mary.
Yeah, let's not blaspheme on the National Public Radio program.
Let me say to you the silences are the first, the pauses are the exact first thing they cut out in Hollywood. You never see that in a movie anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just. Forget about it. And that's what thrilled me about this movie. I mean,
it's like the space between the notes and music. They're important, really important.
Boy, get it on the space.
Yeah. Let me ask Dr. Williams here. Are we dealing with what has been called pedophilia, or is there something else at play in the film here? Is he's called a pedophile. Is he a pedophile, or are there other explanations for it, for the priestly abuse?
Can you say that again? What is it that is this pedophilia?
Is it a single act of abuse, or is it? Do you get the sense that this man is there? That he has a mental disorder called pedophilia?
Right. It's one of the things actually in learning to become in becoming a psychologist that was interesting is you know, the people who we diagnose are humans as well. They don't come to you with a sign that says I am a pedophile. You know, they're people that are struggling with a certain, you know, difficulty or disorder. I think it's ambiguous here. What's going on or what's happened. He could very well have pedophilia, and that could be one part of the picture or you know, how one might understand what's happened.
But not necessarily. The Father Sam doesn't necessarily have to be a pedophile, does he? With one act of abuse, or can you diagnose that?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to diagnose it from what we can see, you know, here. I'm not sure if we have enough evidence, but that would certainly be one of the hypotheses, wouldn't it?
Michael, when all the priestly abuse, the scandal broke, I guess in the early 90s, mid 80s, there was a lot of talk about how it was tied to the vow of chastity, priestly celibacy, and that kind of thing. Is there a connection, do you think, between all of the abuse and the vows that the priests take?
There might be in some cases. I don't think there is naturally between a vow of celibacy and any kind of pedophilia behavior. I think the larger problem, and it's been the problem in the way the Roman Catholic Church has addressed it, and increasingly it's addressing it in the correct way, and I think under the current pontiff with the establishment of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of the Rights of Minorities, you see with people like Cardinal O'Malley of Boston, and more particularly the Baroness Sheila Collins, a very prominent British psychiatrist who's now going to be part of this commission, that we're addressing the larger issue, which is an issue of power and an issue of accountability. And those are the primary things, I think, around the whole sexual abuse crisis. Because I don't think, if you actually look at the statistics, that you're going to find an egregious representation of pedophiles or pedophiles among Roman Catholic clergy. I think what we found in terms of the crisis was a crisis around failure of institutional accountability. Mm. And well, that is the issue that I think has to be addressed.
That was what was egregious, was the cover-up, really.
It was
moving priests to,
yes,
from
yes,
parish to parish. You saw that, did you, yourself?
Yeah, I did. I was in a in one of the smaller parishes, and the priest was away for a little bit of a break, and I showed up on a Monday morning, and the priest that was going to be offering Mass that day was a priest that I knew was on a list that was not to be celebrating Mass in the diocese because of his past around pedophilia and relationships with young boys. And, you know, so that started a chain of events. But, you know, certainly, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know it. No parishioners would have known it. He could have just been there all week. But, you know, it puts people at risk, and there were altar boys at risk.
Doctor?
Yeah, if I could follow up, I think like one of the things that we do see, you know, it's like the pedophilia part is not, you know, front and center, but what we do see is someone who is very compartmentalized. You know, he, you know, his issues of his sexuality, issues of who he is are kind of hidden from himself. They're kind of literally, you know, this man has taken this episode and put it, we see him sort of take this picture out of a box, you know, so... I think what he's done is there's, you know, in order to kind of shield himself or to kind of keep this part about himself that he's struggled with, he's kind of built walls around it. And I think that's the bigger issue here, is that he hasn't really been able to integrate a sense of who he is in his life and in his interactions with others.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yes. No, I remembered what I was trying to say.
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah. Back
when
to 20 minutes
kid,
ago.
But this ties in, I hope. When I was a kid, they used to get you, I mean, you could go to, we had what they called junior seminaries, and you could start at 14, It was just, and some of these poor guys, I was in the Boy Scouts, and we were sleeping around the old campfire with a ton of seminarians, and, you know, one of them taught me how to smoke cigarettes, I remember, it was a really, and these guys had never had any kind of relationship with women. I mean, it was like, I had at least by that time had played post office with, Anne Louise Linderman or something.
Right.
But we didn't, these kids, and they were kids, and we looked up to them because they'd be teenagers, and we were in the fourth grade, fifth grade, something like that. And I never had any, nobody ever, gave me any trouble along those lines. But you could see they were in this entirely male scene. And there was a lot of sort of bonding going on in the best sense of the term. I mean, we looked up to these guys, and they were nice guys, most of them. And you can see how this thing kind of happens somehow, and especially smaller degrees of it. I mean, there are like plenty of degrees of it, I guess, about what goes on. So I justified a lot of that when I was thinking about what happened with him. And there was cigarettes and all that stuff.
The way you play Father Sam, though, particularly in the moments where he's alone in the rectory, there's this tremendous sense of loneliness, of remoteness and removal. And I'm wondering, Doctor, how loneliness plays into this. You say he compartmentalizes everything.
Absolutely. I think
including the loneliness.
I think the picture shows that well, the sense of isolation and loneliness. And again, I think he, you don't get a sense of someone who's necessarily sad. Although he's alone and isolated, he seems to be fairly flat. We don't get, he's even compartmentalized from himself, really. He's not well connected, with what's going on. There's not a lot of sense of emotion. And certainly, it can be a lonely vocation, and particularly these days now, when there are, one single priest for a number of different, parishes. These guys are working on their own quite a lot, rather than being sort of three priests in one parish.
Deirdre and then Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Community was so important, right? When they lived together, I could see how much healthier that would have been. And I reflect on that often around Christmas because I worked for really, really good men. But the one guy it'd be Christmas, Mass was over, it was midnight Mass, so it's already 2 a.m. I can't wait to go home to bed because I've got to be back for Mass first thing in the morning. And he just wants to talk, like he wants to have the turkey dinner now and let's stay up all night and please like don't leave me because, everybody else is going home to family and he's staying by himself. It's a pretty sad place.
Michael?
I think, and I was conscious of this as I was watching the film. A line that kept going through my head was the line by the poet Eliot that most people live lives of quiet desperation. And in this particular case, it's not just a life of quiet desperation. It's much more dramatic than that. There is something about him in terms of a almost doomed heroism. Sam is insulated not only from his own psychosexual maturity. He's insulated by the nature of his mystique. You're very conscious of the fact that everything is routinized. It's determined by rubrics. It's determined by how the mystique of his office functions. He's a priest. This is what he's expected to do. This is how he's expected to perform. It seems to me that when you're subsumed into the office or to that function, you lose something of your humanity. So when he's struggling to break out, his relationship with his sister, for instance, his occasional struggles with trying to make connections with people. You can see him trying to break out, not of the presbyterate, not of the priesthood, but the image of the priesthood we've embedded, inculcated, not only in terms of what the priest, how the priest understands himself, but how Catholics understand the priest to perform. As a consequence, we increasingly reduce him to a place of really acute desperation, not just quiet, but acute desperation.
I found that when you were playing, Michael, when you were, again, going back to this dartboard scene with the young gay man, and he says, am I going to go to hell? And Father Sam says, no, I don't. It seems to me he was kind of reaching out to that young man and saying, I'm not a monster, and I'm not judging you. I found that a very powerful conversation.
That was important, I think. And I'm certain that in the modern church, I mean, there are tons of priests that feel that way. And tons of priests that feel that, you know, birth control is fine. You know, and they just sort of, like he also said in that scene, he says, how does it work? And he says, I don't know. No guarantees. Yeah.
Do you think his vocation was in trouble? Do you think he was?
I think it was real.
Questioning it.
Do I detect a hint of the Irish going on down there?
No. I'm a native Frontonian. Just trying to confuse you here. But you know what I wanted to ask is I think you carried very well the kind of cloak of sadness with him.
Yeah.
Right? And even when the car doesn't start.
Yeah.
Or other things happen throughout the course of the film, he never erupts into anger. He just gets sad.
Yeah. I thought he was going to do that in the car.
Exactly.
I thought he was going to say.
And you want him to do that. Yeah. Maybe that's the Irish.
Terry,
you want him to do that.
Like
exactly. Grab it. Yeah, but he doesn't.
Like you're anointing the car.
Yeah, exactly,
that's right.
Yeah.
But it's also a sense that you have to be controlled in public. Like there's things that are expected of you.
Yes.
So he's actually shackled by his vocation. Yeah. Rather than liberated, but I have a tremendous sense of a man wrestling with his conscience. You evoke a figure of considerable sympathy. Actually,
right.
you don't look at him as a depraved human being.
Yeah, that's
Dr. Williams. Yeah.
I was going to say that there is something that's genuine about him. Like when he's responding to that the man who is gay and saying, no, I don't think that you're going to go to hell because of that. But at the same time, there's a kind of a shallowness to him. This guy is kind of, I think it's more like, my sense was it's more the other characters around that were like you were saying, like, say something, yell, scream. There's more of a shallowness to him. This guy is calling to him and saying, what do you think about this? You're the expert. You should be able to tell me. And he's like, well, I haven't thought
he's
about
in
that
deep
much.
Into his own.
He says, oh no, you're not going to hell. But then he almost condemns him to death again by his silence, by saying, yeah, I don't dwell on that a lot. Yeah. And I've worked with also, many of us know priests. We won't talk about that and it'll all be okay. Don't ask, don't tell, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and part of this was that, you're having a conversation with somebody about he's received this letter and he's kind of distracted, which I was trying to get in there. He's got his own fish to fry at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get it totally.
This was a boy that he was
that's
with.
That's right.
So it's like, what, you haven't thought about this?
Yeah,
exactly.
Sure. And the reason I brought up the Irish thing was that, it was my experience that it was essentially the Irish church here, and we're a superstitious, clannish bunch.
That's right.
And you give your firstborn son to the church, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And a lot of people did that.
And heirs to a certain kind of Jansenism or Catholic Puritanism, right?
Exactly.
And it kind of seeped into the already melancholy soul of the Irish, right? Now you've really got
that's
it working,
right.
Stirring things up there. But you don't smile a lot in the film. There are a couple of points, that lovely line when you say, well, you didn't go overboard on the tree, right? I mean, that's quite a relief. But it's almost as if, in a sense, and that's why I keep going back to the idea of self-insulating, you're defined by the role rather than allowing yourself to emerge out of that role. I'm not talking about the actor's role. I'm talking about the role of the priest, right? And this seems to me in some way to be inhibitive. And that's why Sam Ryan is a very attractive figure, I think. I'm not sure. I understand your point about the shallowness. I'm not sure he's so much shallow as he's just constantly, and there was this word used in the film, evasive. Mm-hmm. Evasion protects him.
Yeah.
If I just don't maybe that's a form of shallowness, but if I just don't directly confront this, right, if I just carry on by following the rubrics, following the rituals, being the priest you want me to be, and then with the young woman, of course, he doesn't judge her,
And he does say quietly that he will witness their marriage, right? But I mean, he has to maneuver his way around the issue of conscience.
Deirdre?
Well, I think the other way that the film shows this evasiveness is through these reflective mirrors. Like everything is, yes, you know, from an inside out or outside in through these mirrors. And of course, windows, I should say, but it reminded me of Paul to the Corinthians, you know, now I look through the mirror half dimly and, you know, but soon I'll see the, you know, more fully. And I think that also, and leaving your glasses behind, you know, you dummy, like how can you function without that? But there they sat and very strongly, clearly a symbol that, you know, here's this guy like who can't really see everything, but is really working hard to see other people's needs and can barely even manage his own, you know, realities.
I have to ask Michael Murphy this because we're both pre-Vatican II. Irish Catholic Church nuns, all of that. Yeah, that's exactly right. The film, the character and the film, and all the attendant emotions around it, plus the abuse scandal, plus the various corruptions of the political Vatican. Is that what's been the impact of your view of the church with all of that? Because I was raised knowing that I was going to go to hell if I didn't do the right thing and go to confession every Saturday.
That's right.
Yeah. You know?
And keep the Holy Ghost between you and that girl.
That's right.
Yeah.
You used to walk out of the church on Saturday after confession, hoping to get hit by a cement truck you first had the first dirty thought,
right.
You know?
Impure thought, my
impure.
Man.
It lasted about 8 seconds, but
I was driving that truck.
You're hoping to
in an earlier life.
But has it? How does it?
It was such an interesting trip. I had really let go of it in a big way. I mean, I just thought to myself, and I went to Mass until I was deep in my 20s, and I had 12 years of Catholic school, those nuns, and then the Jesuits were a lot cooler. They were. Mm-hmm. They thought, you know, flirting with girls was funny, and you know, they got on with it a little bit. But still, it was pre-Vatican, you know, and I had two sisters who just sort of went, oh yeah, I take what I. They were cafeteria Catholics as young kids, but I took it more seriously. I mean, I thought, oh God, you know, I keep looking at, you know, Sharon Ryan over there. I'm going to go be in hell in a second. You know,
I was looking at her, too.
And that's really tough.
You know, the thing is, while you were getting ready to leave, I was just coming in. I became a Catholic at 16 because I fell in love with a girl. So you want to talk about a trip?
Wow. Time to get that truck out again.
Can you help me?
That's amazing, yeah.
Where do you see the church now? I mean, coming through this so-called crisis, not so-called, that's what it is or has been, the impact on that, the pews are empty or emptying.
Yeah, that's great, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That spiraling down of the church and him and that...
The Christmas Mass.
Yeah.
There were 12 people or whatever in the pew. Where does that leave? What kind of church do we have today, Michael?
Well, I, Michael. Yeah, I think that there is actually enormous vitality in the church. I mean, you've got to remember that very often people went for reasons of social constraint and expectation, right? I mean, these were tribal reasons. You were a Catholic, you weren't a Protestant. These were certain things that you did. There were certain things you were expected to do. It seems to me now that people who go to celebrate the Eucharist go because they wish to do so, because they're fed by the Eucharist, because it matters to them greatly. I got to tell you, I mean, I move around in church circles all the time as a critic and as a scholar.
You're a secular pope is what you are.
I've been called that, not in flattering terms. But one of the things that has always struck me is that the Mass is usually always full at Christmas, and the high holy days are still very much moments of connection with your memory, connection with your community. And it does seem to me that shift to a different understanding of membership and engagement in the church is one of the more profound but subtle shifts that have occurred. I'll give you a perfect example, and then we'll pass on to somebody else. And statistically, we still try to determine how Catholic people are in their practice, and we ask them questions, which, and we expect them to fill in certain blanks and to say certain things. They don't.
The younger generation don't think the same way. For us, if we didn't go to weekly mass, it meant that in some way we were lapsed or failed or lacking the appropriate level of contrition. Many Catholics now of a younger generation, my own children's generation, might go to mass once a month and they would consider themselves practicing. That's a very different metric than what we've been accustomed to. And so we tend to look at things declining in ecclesial life using a different measuring stick.
And I
think we have to shift this a bit to understand. I one of the things that struck me there is that the people who actually were there in community authentically were people of faith.
Sure.
They were there for a reason.
But they said the wrong words in the response.
Oh,
did you notice? Rubric,
yes, we have to talk to the director about
the
that.
The Lord be with you, and also with your spirit is not what we say at Mass today. Right. So anyway, you know, a whole bunch of people are going to learn the wrong words from the film. But that's okay. Yeah. You know, I think there was a much more important
they
message
in
that.
They should have left it in Latin, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Latin, I know. Yeah.
But, you know, there are. I happen to belong to a parish that's very rich, and it's... connection and it's welcome and connectivity and the pews aren't empty, but it's rare, I think, for like some of the downtown parishes in the city where I am and in a number of places. But the people who are there with their authenticity, with what they're longing for, I think, in the same way that Father Sam was, again, longing for that redemption. You know, you just look for whatever you can for a message of hope in all kinds of ways of the darkness.
I wanted to say, I mean, and this is maybe a bit of a different answer to your question, but I think I see the very best of the church when I go to work every day. So I work at this residential treatment facility, and I work, you know, this character, Father Sam, could easily be one of our residents. And I remember there was one of our former CEOs, I was having a conversation with him one day when we were working with some particularly difficult situations, and he was kind of in a crisis, sort of like, oh, what is this our church? Are these the priests, you know? And I said, you know, I really feel like we are speaking God's word into these people's lives. We're sort of shining light or shining truth. These are people who are facing difficult, upsetting things that they've done, and they are, you know, being faced with the truth of it. They're often acknowledging this, working through it, and working towards healing. So,
but I guess what troubles me is when I was growing up in the family, there was always talk about priests having trouble with Punch or Judy, drink or women. That was the. But now it's priests are under suspicion all the time. Is he one or is he not? Are my children safe if my daughter wants to be an altar server or my son? And that must be utterly destructive, is it not?
This is what I really forgot. This priest.
It's all coming
this,
back,
this priest
isn't it?
Yeah. That I like so much. Yeah, he told me. He said he would walk in a restaurant and he was a very, you know, kind of macho guy. I mean, he said I can't walk into a place if somebody doesn't make some snide remark. Yeah. He said this has followed me around my whole life, and I'm not into any of that stuff, you know, and I don't like it, you know.
You know, the nuns stopped wearing habits long ago for different reasons than what's happening now, but I meet so many priests who there's no way that they're going to wear a collar out in public.
Really?
It's just, and it's sad, you know, this was something they commit their lives to, they work hard to be good people, so many of them, and this is one of the symbols, and it also allows people, you know, to come up and talk to, you know, lots of people will approach you when you do have the collar, but I, you know, they won't wear it, especially in Ireland, you know, a priest that I know particularly just says no. Yeah, because if he wears that walking down the street, he will for sure get slurs.
No, Ireland's become a clerical wasteland.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was so tough. I mean...
Well, it was, wow. and it's interesting actually to look at the experience of Ireland. It's perhaps a little extreme, but it is a microcosm, I think, of the larger challenges within the Roman Catholic Church. It isn't just simply a matter of demoralization among some of the clergy and indeed among some of the bishops. I mean, I think what it is a matter of ridding the presbyterate of all its remaining vestiges of clericalism, because that's what we're really dealing with here. We're not dealing with a problem in the priesthood, we're dealing with a problem of clericalism.
I mean, what do you mean by that? Isn't it a problem with the priesthood? I'm sorry.
Well, no, well, the priesthood, when it is seen as a clerical state, as something of that it has about it an exceptional ontological reality, that somehow it's above or separate from, anointed or distinct from. It creates a culture which actually runs counter to the gospel. And it seems to me that there are all kinds of reasons why popes, most particularly and recently, have talked about the sin of anticlericalism. Well, good grief! I mean, what are clerics? If you know, they're clerics, right? They're priests. So how do you take the presbyterate or the priesthood and you strip away the qualities of clericalism that have reduced it to a simple functionary role, and in addition to that, an exalted role, both expectations of which make the life of the priest almost impossible to achieve with any degree of maturity and intelligent serenity. I mean, they're dealing with types of what it is to be human. So I think the crisis we're in right now is purgative, cathartic, and necessary.
Let me ask you, Michael, coming away from the film, what would you want audiences to take from the film, and specifically, what would you want Catholics to take from it?
I'd like them to see this guy as a human being, and I'd like it to start a conversation about this thing. I wanted to put a human face on it in a way. I wanted to make a good picture. I wanted to make a picture about a guy that was, this obviously hovers over it. It could be any secret, a tough secret, but I wanted to. Just show this old guy and what he'd been through and how he was dealing with it, and how I love this whole idea of the, you know, here we are in Niagara Falls, which once, you know, was, you took your, you know, was the honeymoon capital of the world, and it's kind of like on its knees, and the parish is on its knees, everything's kind of circling a drain, and he's looking back on his life as much as anything and saying, you know, I don't know, was it all worth it? Was it? I was quoted in the paper the other day of saying, you know, it's like an actor, you get to the end of the road and you say, so I made a few movies, so what? You know, but what I was really talking about, they took that out of context, was a priest looking back and saying, geez, I hope this was, you know, did I do this for my mother, or did I get anything out of it, or, you know, how did this work out, and do I still believe all this stuff? You say Mass a couple of 100,000 times, how boring does that get, you know?
When we talk about Michael Murphy's movies, we don't say, so what? Thank you, and thank you all. Thank you. Michael Higgins, Dr. Williamson, thank you. Deirdre Pike, Michael Murphy, thank you very much.
That was great.
That was terrific.
I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
That was fun.
Yeah, that was.